This is episode 28 of Breeze and Freedom for Tuesday, May 8th, 2012. Hi, I'm Karen Sandler.
And I'm Bradley Kuhn.
This is Breeze and Freedom.
And I was going to say the continuing Fosdem stories, but I said that last time.
Did you?
Yep. So we're still going through these recordings. Nobody's actually complained, though, that we've gone through them.
That means people aren't listening or they like it.
I guess. I don't know. I don't know what's happening. So a number of people wrote in about the whole codes thing. And I told them that I wasn't going to mention them by name, but that I would mention that many people wrote in and had various opinions. Many of them had arguments about why it should be code and that that's syntactically correct.
Language reasons. Is a tough thing.
I don't know. I just think that it's we should have more rigorous approaches to these things.
Well, English is pretty terrible for consistent rules anyway.
They can write them now. I don't know. I just hate that usage defines language. That's just not right.
I love that.
Well, because stupid phrases.
I think it's calling things what they are.
No, that's wrong. So we've picked, I think we only have a couple of Fosdem talks left.
Yep.
I don't know, are we going to do this next year? We're going to do this track next year. Are we going to record everything again and play everything on the show?
I don't know. I mean, we actually haven't played it. We're not going to play every talk from that session.
That's true. Some of the recordings didn't turn out well. Like, and Dave Neary's talk, sadly, it was just too much Q&A, and there was no mics in the audience. And
yep, and just that, you know, and there were other talks, too, that just weren't, that the recording wasn't so good.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, it'll also depend on what the format is next year. I mean, I sort of felt like the problem, one of the reasons why these recordings are so good here on this podcast is that they're short, which is nice. But in person, it was like kind of a frustrating length. It was a little too short. We talked about this at the time.
Yeah, there'll probably be longer slots next year. Actually, I think
so. There'll be fewer talks.
I think that Fosdem should
standardize
on the time slot times for all the things. It was a real problem.
That would
problem.
Be so much better because you pretty much have to understand that you're going to miss a whole talk's worth if you switch tracks. The way it was this past year.
Yep, that's correct.
And going between the legal room and the desktop room was really just stuff I'd miss a lot.
It's always been that way though.
Yeah, it really sucks.
Yeah, I mean that's that. But see, the thing is that there's a lot of other weird things that people complain about Fosdem. But I think that one is livable. All the other ones are livable. If they just fix that thing where all tracks had the same slots, everything else would be fine. Maybe they do that because they're worried about the halls being too crowded for the change. At the breaks, right? Because it could be. Of course, they're at school. They're used to dealing with this,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. It doesn't really make a lot of sense to me. Because there are times when everybody is, you know, at the beginning of the day. And
that's true.
There are other times when it's crowded. Actually, kind of fun when it's really swamped.
Yeah. But they have all those rules about the. Anyway. Well, we're going next year. It'll be my second trip to Fosdem. I should have been going all along, obviously. I also didn't realize how much the dev rooms were really the conference. That's what I didn't realize.
Yeah.
Like, and I would look at the main track and I'd be like, well, my talk didn't get accepted on the main track, and which it never does, which I realized the main track is basically it's the keynotes.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that. I thought the main track was just the main track. And then there was all these other, like, I thought they were breakout rooms. That's what I thought Fosdem was.
No, but it's interesting because the keynotes or the main track happened at the same time when there were so many other talks going on. So it also wasn't like a real keynote either. It's really interesting. It's like, you know, I thought beforehand that the main track was somehow, I don't know, was more exciting than it was. Not that the talks weren't exciting or anything like that. It's just, you know, and I had real criticisms about it because I was surprised that there was only one woman in the entire main track. And I was just kind of surprised. I didn't really want to complain about it because I'd submitted a talk and it wasn't accepted and I don't mind about that. So that was totally fine. But it was just one of those things where I sort of thought that they were really more like keynotes. And then when we were there, I realized that there were so many other talks going on at the same time that I barely made it to any main track talks.
Mm-hmm. There were two that really were keynotes. I forget whose they were, where there was nothing against them. I'm trying to remember. I forget whose they were, but anyway. So this is, Loic which we're not going to hear this from crying and ask this to be cut out because.
You are?
Of course I am. That was hilarious. It's going to be cut out. Sorry. But, I've never really said Loic's name right. And I think I have got it now.
Loic?
That's apparently it. Well, you took French, so you know how to speak French.
Well, I don't know how to speak French for starters. And secondly, I mispronounce all sorts of things, being a terrible, terribly uneducated American.
So I actually, I actually asked Loic to submit.
Dacharie? Is that how?
You say it because you're French or you know French. Because you know French.
Neither of those things are correct, Bradley.
I asked him to submit a talk roughly around this topic, and he agreed. And it's related to Michael Meek's talk, which he makes reference to during the talk, because it's about the issue of companies and enforcement, and can companies do enforcement and still be effectively moral and ethical? And considering the question, I think it's really interesting. I don't know if Loic has said publicly where he works now. He does not in the talk, and I don't know if he has yet. You can actually figure it out from context and searching around, but I won't say it since he hasn't said
it. I actually thought it was in the slides, which I didn't.
Oh, may have been. We may or may not have the slides, because Loic is so busy with his new job. He recently said to me on IRC, "We're busy bees." He said that.
Okay.
That was an interesting phrase. It's weird when people who aren't native English speakers use a
idiomatic expression.
Idiomatic expression that's kind of quaint, and I don't know if Loic realizes that it's like really kind of a.
I don't know. I've heard English speakers say that.
They do say that. It's just I would never expect a developer to say it. Let's put it that way. Like that's not how.
But Loic is an individual. He says a lot of things that I wouldn't expect developers to say.
That is true, actually. That is true.
I mean that in the coolest developer of all possible ways.
Yeah, he's a very unique developer. I mean, I've known him for a long time. I've never told publicly the story of when I met him. The conversation actually went like this. I met him in 2000, finally in person. I knew him as a GNU contributor for many years. And he was standing at it was actually the man, get this people, the Mandrake party at Solutions GNU Linux conference, which no longer exists, company which no longer exists, and Mandrake eventually was bought by the Connectiva, and they became Mandriva, and now there's actually stuff about them trying to stay in business even to this day, but they sort of are defunct, but desperately trying to stay in existence as a distribution. Anyway, and Henry Poole, who is now on the Free Software Foundation board, was CEO of Mandrake at the time, just recently announced, and he was there hosting this party, and then I saw Loic there, and I recognized him from his online picture. Mm-hmm. And I said, "You're Loic." And he said, "Who?" I said, "You are, and you're famous." And he turned around 360 degrees and said, "Where?" That was my first conversation.
I could imagine that happening.
So anyway, his English was not as good in those days, but it was a very funny exchange. Anyway, so I think he's a famous free software developer. He doesn't think of himself as famous, but he's been involved with free software a very long time and was really watching this whole thing happen with MySQL AB and how GPL was used, and having been involved with enforcement himself in France. I think it's all very interesting, and obviously I agree with him about a lot of stuff, so it's very easy for me to agree so easily.
I think we all do. Meaning me and you.
Yeah. And Loic is also on the board of Software Freedom Conservancy. I forgot to mention that.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah. He didn't mention that in his talk, but that's okay.
Yeah.
His slides may be online. I think the talk is fine without the slides. I'm going to ask Dan to leave the first question in because it's completely audible when I listen to it. The ones after that were not, so we're going to cut those. And have a listen.
Yeah, I think I know you were just about to stop. I was going to say one of the things that's interesting about it is it gives you a flavor of some of the enforcement that happens more casually over the years. A lot of it turned into more formal enforcement that Loic has been involved in. But I think there's a lot of that, like, just, you know, calling people up and asking them if they would comply. A lot of, like, sort of early level enforcement work that happens. And many people wouldn't even consider it to be enforcement work as such. And, you know, Loic said, in his talk, you know, I didn't take it professional.
Yeah, I know. It's funny that he said, well, let's play the talk.
Oh, yeah,
and
yeah,
about
right, that. Okay.
and he is going to speak about something that we invited him to talk about, which is this idea of what happens when for-profit companies attempt to use the GPL and copyleft in complicated ways, and is it possible to do copyleft without doing that kind of corruption? So, with that, Louis.
Hey. So, yeah, the topic is introduced, so I don't need, and there is a spoiler, that is, the answer will be yes, and I'm particularly interested in this answer because of my background, which I will explain. So, I'm a developer, I write code, I've wrote code for 25 years now, and I happen to have done enforcement as a volunteer for the FSF in France for 10 years. It happened by accident, and I never went pro as SFLC or the Free Software Foundation. And because I was the only one interested in that in France, I came upon very simple cases where someone would call and ask to talk to FSF France, and I would answer, and it would end within a day. And a 1 hour discussion, and the problem was over. The enforcement problem was over. And there were also extremely complicated cases, like the one I started in 2001, which was helping a governmental agency who had been delivered a VNC implementation in violation of the license. And their provider, so the agency was AFPA, and the violator was EDU4. And so they went to us to ask what happens. It's free software, we don't know anything about it. And the violator went to us too, to the Free Software Foundation friend, and asked if we did something wrong. We don't think we did. And we were in a very bizarre situation where it got all very, very complicated because there was a lot of money. It was a contract that was 10 million euros at the time. And so it dragged for almost 10 years and was eventually resolved in 2010 by the Court of Appeal in France, ruling against the violator. And then the Supreme Court in French, which is called Cour de Cassation, who denied the appeal of the violator to run again. So that was the longest case I ever worked on. And in between, I always did that on my spare time. Now, the topic of this talk is of particular interest to me because I started recently to work for a for-profit company. And as part of my work, I have a free software contract. That is, I'm like this vegetarian people. I refuse to use free software. Use proprietary software. I refuse to write proprietary software, and there is no question about using a little bit of it, just like a vegetarian would not accept to eat a little bit of meat. And so all the companies I apply to just refuse my candidacy because of that, except one recently accepted it. I will not name it because the context of this talk is quite controversial. But that's where this interest came to me. So the global context of this talk is we think of a company who has a service, has a possible service business model. Like if you think MySQL, for most people, they just sold services. They had a great free software out there. And people would come to them and ask to port it to different contexts to add some features, etc. So they would actually sell time. And that's also the context in which my current company is. It's a cloud making company. They do some managed hosting. They are turning into trying to place themselves in the cloud, because managed hosting is something of the past and the cloud is the future. So they really sell their expertise, which is powered by manpower, not by selling proprietary licenses. So in a sense, the context of this talk is when a company has the ability to do that. MySQL had this possibility because they had a software that was widely distributed to the point that it became a de facto standard, allowing them to sell services. In the context of my company, it's not really that, because we didn't produce any software yet. But still, I don't see how a hosting company could sell proprietary software. It makes no sense. So the problem is that MySQL really had a proprietary software business model on top of their, or maybe under their services business model. When a potential customer came to them and say, this free software stuff is great, but that's not for me. I'm kind of against this principle, and I would like to make proprietary software out of your software. Then they would agree to that and grant the company a proprietary license of MySQL. So this has nothing to do with free software. And in order to do that, there is no other way than being the sole owner of the copyright of the software. Otherwise, it does not work. And that comes back to the Michael Meek's talk and Allison's talk. This is the only possible way to do that. Now, when you do copyleft, you must be prepared to enforce the license. Otherwise, it makes no sense. I mean, if you do copyleft and when something happens that violates the license, you must be at least prepared to go to the person who does wrong to ask kindly, please do something about it. So that happens all the time, because the software is copied in binary form and then given away. And when that happens, most of the time, in the corporate context, there is no source to come with it. People forget about it. Then, usually, you go to the violator, you ask for them to go in compliance, to give their customer or their user the corresponding source code for their binary, so that they can exercise their rights under the copyleft license. When this fails, maybe because they don't want to talk to you, maybe because you don't talk to the right person, you can get a lawyer involved. And not in not going to court, but actually have a lawyer and send a letter to the violator, asking in a less kind way, please provide the complete and corresponding source code. And if it all fails, like in the case I was talking about, AFPA against EG4, then you go to court and you have judges involved and it gets really ugly. So that's what license enforcement is about. Now, in the context of a nonprofit, which is the context which I know, what we demand is fairly simple. We demand compliance. When someone violates the license for many years, all we ask from them is that they comply to the copyleft license. We ask also for a financial compensation, because if we have to have lawyers involved, or if we have to have the employees of the nonprofit paid to care for this specific violation, then it costs. And it would be unfair that the donators to the nonprofit pay for the mistakes of the company. So we would ask for the company to reimburse the legal employees' time. We would also ask extended things in exchange for reinstating their rights under the license. That is, we make a lot of efforts to go to the violator and explain to them what they should do, but we are not focusing on a narrow area. If, for instance, you have a ISP provider with a box and there is BusyBox inside or IP tables and a lot of other free software, when we ask for compliance, we don't just ask for compliance for our stuff, for the stuff for which we represent an author. We would ask that please also make it right to the other copyleft software, which they usually do. Where, that's a bit of a mix with the next slide. So MySQL was not known to do that. They were known to require the acquisition of a proprietary license, which is a repeat of that. So what happens when you are a for-profit like MySQL? Of course, you don't have the same agenda. So you see that honest mistakes are made all the time. What happens when you see someone who is very wealthy, who made a mistake and lost his right under the license? That is, he is not allowed to use MySQL anymore. He is not allowed to use the copyleft. So you go to them, you explain to them that they have either to get rid of this software or to negotiate with you. But now your demands as a for-profit company would be completely different. When you have someone who has a lot of money, you're not thinking about the future of free software. You're thinking about your profit. So in a sense, the distribution of free software acts for your benefit in the same kind of way the illegal copies of proprietary software act. You know that I've been told that there are more than 50% of the Windows license out there which are illegal. But then you hear that Microsoft claims that they have 90% of the market, so it plays in their benefit too. And also when they go after a corporation that has illegal copies, they make money out of it. It's pre-sales. So, in the end, so I repeat, MySQL was known to ask that in exchange for coming into compliance, they would buy a proprietary license of their product instead of just going to compliance. Unfortunately, there is a conflict when a company does that, has that kind of strategy, and because the agenda of the free software community is different, and when a company does that, it scares the people away from free software. I will not repeat all the other problems that have already been stated by the fact that you have just one company owning all the copyright and so on. But just for this enforcement act, this is bad for the reputation of free software as a whole. Not because we go to enforce our rights. As a nonprofit, when you ask for compliance, this is good. Copyleft exists to be respected. But if you go out and enforce for the money and hit hard on an honest mistake, then So now I'm in a company. So I must be careful not to repeat that mistake. I figured out that it would be really simple to have a solution by just applying this three points. We publish under a copyleft license. We are in the cloud, and I partly disagree with Michael on that. We need AGPL, not ALGPL. We are specifically based on OpenStack layer, which is under permissive license. And because of that, the 200 companies that are known to work on OpenStack, which is a fairly recent project, only do proprietary software on top of this permissive license. So we are in a context where if we write a software, we would be the only one writing free software. So we must take the step of protecting ourselves from all these other companies who would just rip off our free software and make it into proprietary software. If we chose a possible ALGPL, we would also give them permission to do that. From a business point of view, it does not make sense. So we go for copyleft, strong copyleft, to face our proprietary competitors. Then we want to control copyright on significant portions. One of the problems of enforcing copyrights is that when you go to court, in about everywhere in the world, but specifically in France, you must show that you own copyright on a designated portion of the code that is deemed original, that can be identified by the judge as a work, as a whole. It's not enough in France specifically to just say, I did 80% of the commits. You need to be able to say on this part, and it must not be just one file, on this part, I did it myself. And then you can enforce copyright for the whole. You only need a specific portion to go to court and enforce. And then as part of the negotiation to reinstate the violator into his rights, we would ask that the wall is respected. But we only need a significant part to go to court. And there comes the third precaution to avoid being corrupt, is that you don't own the copyright of the wall. You make sure you depend on other copyleft software. It could be because you have some contributions of your software which are copyleft. That is, you accept, without a contributor license agreement, a significant contribution that is copyleft, and the author is someone else. That's actually something where I'm currently hunting for people who want to work with us on specific portions and own their own copyright. And with that, we have a diverse, as the pie Michael was showing, we have a diverse copyright ownership that prevents us as a company to do malpractice on behalf of the community as well. I don't see any flaw in that, but I thought about it only a month and a half ago, so if you see anything wrong, I'd be happy to discuss it. One of the advantages of doing that when I start to work in the company is that it's a lot easier to do it at the beginning when the stakes are not big. Maybe in 3 years from now, if we're not too stupid, we will have a nice piece of software. But then it will be a lot more difficult to convince the management and the lawyers and the investors that this is a good idea, because they will see that ownership of the code can translate into proprietary software. But if we did do that from the beginning, in 3 years from now, they would have no choice. So they will think about something else. And that would be good for free software and for us. I think I said that already, right? And so that's it. I tailored that for 20 minutes because I wanted your input. Maybe I did. I said something wrong, or maybe you already thought about something else to avoid corruption, and for questions. Thank you.
Yep. This point about adding copyleft dependencies is very useful as well if you worry that your management might at some point in, down the line decide that this whole free software thing was a mistake and change their mind. If you have included a copyleft dependency, then that decision would come with a decision to rewrite that part and remove it somehow. And this is not a decision that typical software companies choose to make. And that would save you from having to make the difficult decision of whether to carry on working in what is now proprietary software or finding a new job.
Yeah. And I must say that even that decision at a very early stage is not common. I mean, finding a CEO who is not dumb, taking this decision, he clearly sees that he will never be able to go back. But it's also extraordinarily difficult to recruit a technical team that works. So I think in the company we are now three people working for development. It took more than a year for the company to recruit us in the context of the cloud. You may have seen that it's like in the early 2000s with Web 2.0. It's about impossible to hire someone who is competent. So here we stand. We can have that kind of demands, and they would say, okay, we don't like it, but okay.
So now we're back after the talk, but for us it's just right.
You were saying before we listened about taking a professional. Actually, I wasn't in the room because, as people know from the continuing FOSDEM stories, that I was managing the queue outside during the talks and so forth. So I didn't hear the talks when they happened. So I heard this in the recording later, and I wish I'd been in the room when he said professional, because in some sense what he's saying is that I'm a professional GPL enforcer. And I think that was an important thing to point out, that there's a lot of would-be GPL enforcement. A great example is the whole VLC thing in the App Store. I mean, that was basically a community enforcement effort that happened. And I admit that I sometimes ignore that part of the volunteer and community enforcement that's happening.
Yeah, I just think that there's a lot of that going on, because when people find out about it, the first thing they do is they say, hey, you know, you're violating license, or they don't say it that way. They say, where can I get the source code? You don't provide an offer.
Yeah. I think that until listening to Luik's talk, I had not really thought about the fact that that's still all ongoing. In fact, that's how I started and got involved. Mm-hmm. You sort of forget that that's all ongoing. And I intersect that at actually probably its worst point, because what happens with the enforcement I do a lot is I end up being CC'd as the discussion gets contentious, right? So some developer or some user is emailing somebody trying to get source code, and then the conversation has not gone well and it's gotten contentious. So I see a lot of these people who I'm trying to calm down, and I'm like, stop, let's try to do the because we never start enforcement with aggression. And a lot of people have gotten to the point where they're aggressive, and it's new to them. So they're like, it's a travesty from their point of view.
Yeah. Well, right. Because by the time they're contacting you or SFLC or whoever they're contacting about it, they've been frustrated.
Well, there's that. And also, there's the issue of that they, what I mean by they think it's a travesty is that they, basically, it's the first time they've ever encountered a violation. So for them, it's a big deal. I wrote a blog post about this a long time ago where it's not a big deal anymore, because basically it's so mundane to have yet another GPL violation. I see hundreds all the time. But for that specific user who just got that device, it's that feeling of I can't build the source code.
Or especially if it's a developer who sees his own copyrights being, you know, being used in a way that he didn't want them used in. Mm-hmm. So that's frustrating.
Like, and that's the VLC example is a good example of that. And then the fight.
You kind of understand
why
people get so agitated about it, because it's sort of, you know, it's their own work.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just so jaded and seen so much of it that it's, I've somewhat lost the passion. That's the sad part. I keep going on because it's right.
Well, you've also become, you know, really skeptical, or not skeptical, but, you know, it's like people who've worked in the DA's office for a long time start sometimes assuming the worst of people. you know, like, I think you might err on the side of assuming there's a violation.
No, I think I've said, so many. I finally got Dave Turner to clear publicly that I could quote him on this. Dave Turner told me once he didn't want to do GPL enforcement anymore because it made him think like a cop, and he doesn't want to think like a cop.
Yeah, well, that's funny, because you sort of, in the Free as in Freedom channel on Freenode today, today being
May 4th, right, when we're recording, not the date of release.
I did write in the channel that we were recording.
I know.
You were looking over my shoulder.
Oh, you mean just now?
Just now.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, now they're just going to be all complaining that it's not live. I thought you mentioned that we were recording.
Well, nobody said anything.
Oh, okay. They're mostly on
it's pretty
U.S.
late.
They're mostly U.S. Eastern people and European people.
And
so
that's even
between
later
the two of them, between Europe and U.S. Eastern, there's nobody left there.
Yeah.
So I what were you saying about
this? So you said in channel today that I'm becoming a better person the longer I spend working not as a lawyer. And it's exactly those kinds of mentalities that are associated with being a lawyer. So it's really interesting just to hear you say that so soon, so hard on the heels of what you had said earlier today.
Well, I mean, I still work very hard to think about violations, each violation fresh, and not treat it like a cop. I probably my perception of GPL violations is more as sort of a wounded bystander. I mean, that's how I feel, and I'm trying to do the right thing.
Yeah, but you're not really, because you are, in a sense, acting as the...
Oh, sure, but I mean,
once you're the enforcer, you're not...
I'm usually enforcing for either copyrights that are held by conservancy
or
copyrights...
It's exactly like the role of a lawyer, right? Someone's entrusted you with advocating for them and their interests.
Yeah, I guess maybe a little bit, but I'm not a lawyer. I don't want to be a lawyer, because lawyers are mostly people I don't want to be.
Okay.
So the other thing that Luik was talking about that I think is really important is this question of how for-profit companies can do it. And I really liked Luik's attitude. I told him this after the talk. I did hear this beginning of it because I was walking out as he said it that day at Fosdem, this thing about being a vegetarian, because I'm also a vegetarian. And it's really good to use that as an example, because I've always Luik is like my classic example of somebody who's made his entire living basically since the late 80s only doing free software.
That's funny, because that analogy actually kind of rubbed me the wrong way.
Why?
I don't know. I mean, I just sort of felt like, and I know I, not from the way that Luik meant it, because I respect that and I know where he's coming from. I just think that it's tough to sort of, you know, I guess at the end of the day, maybe the analogy holds, right? Which is that the less meat we eat as a society, you know, across the board, the better off we are. And you can say the same thing about proprietary software, you know, and if we could, you know, take measures to reduce our production and consumption.
Right. I know hardcore vegans who have really like advocated strongly to me that I needed to switch. I mean, and I never gave them boo about that, because I'm the same way with the software issue. Right. So I just let them advocate to me that I should be a vegan. And in fact, I worked trying to be more vegan based on their advocacy. I've also had those people tell me that it's much more important to convince meat eaters to be vegetarians than vegetarians to be vegans, just because of an optimization problem.
I think we need ethical agriculture across the board, and I think this ties in with the free software world is the thing. Like I think that it's dangerous if we start skewering folks for, you know, employing some proprietary software.
Well,
because
no, that's not what he was saying. What he was saying was it's a moral choice for him, but his point was not that I'm trying to tell people they should be vegetarian, saying I am a vegetarian, which means that if you say, can you eat meat this one time, it's like, well, nobody asks a vegetarian, like, well, can't you just eat meat right now? And they wouldn't say they're a vegetarian if they eat meat sometimes. Right? So that's his point, is that he treats free software like I do, which is, I'm not going to just make an exception because it's convenient right now.
I mean, I think there are times when it's impossible to interact with society without without having to make some compromises like that. And there are, I'm sure there are analogies in the meat world. Like, there are surely, you know, societal constructs that rely on some exploitations of animals, whether it's, you know, the glue in our stamps that the post office manufacturers, I don't know. I'm just sort of fabricating. But I just think that there are times when you have to interact with it, and it doesn't mean that you should stop advocating for it. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't make good choices for you. It's just that I guess I just worry about how we handle our advocacy and how zealous we are.
Yeah, well, I don't see Luik as a zealous. He's not as zealous as I am. It's a much more personal decision for him about what he will do. I'll just say this because it's an insult to me, not to Luik, that Luik's a much friendlier person than I am, in the sense that Luik will just tell somebody, that's not what I want to do, and he'll go off and do something else, and he won't really tell people, basically, it's in a Stallman-like way, he won't tell somebody this is wrong for what you're doing. It's a personal choice for him. He won't.
I don't know. I mean, I think he speaks out when he sees wrongdoing, which is part of why he gave the speech that he did and why he was
so involved
with FSF France.
True enough. But he has a different style than me.
He definitely has a different style, and I like that a lot. I don't know. I don't mean to be negative. It's just that for some reason that struck me the wrong way. But I did like how he said that he incorporates free software into his employment contract and insists that he will only write free software and no proprietary software. Oh, I thought that was great. I think something that we all could learn from.
Well, this is one of the reasons I get into the argument about developers being the people we need to advocate to, because if every developer in the world did that tomorrow, then proprietary software wouldn't exist anymore. I mean, it's that simple.
I just don't think so because the unreasonableness of getting to that point, particularly when it's so easy to get started now developing in some way or another. I was actually talking to somebody today who thought I had no background in computers whatsoever, even though he was familiar with my work in this field, which I thought was really interesting, thought that I had never programmed at all. And I was saying actually that in some ways it's easier now than when I was doing it because of the languages that are available and the ways that they're already involved. We are generating new developers every day. And the only way we can get them to be convinced that, that proprietary software isn't in the interest of our society is by preaching to society generally and showing how bad it is for us.
Yeah, maybe. If we don't cut down
on the consuming public, then I just think it's going to be forever generated.
So this is a little bit off topic from the week's talk, but I think the reason that it's so difficult to get people to fight for free software now is because there's too much free software. I mean, this is the victim of our success problem that I think nobody ever talks about, which is that because you have a free software operating system now, for anything you want to deploy, what you want to deploy to users, you can do it, and you can build an application on that platform, and all your libraries, all sort of your core dependencies are all free software, most of them LGPL'd or Apache licensed. So you can build an application really it's much easier. You don't even have to go into the operating system business or the compiler business and stuff. I mean, you look at these old companies, these old companies like Intel and Sun now Oracle, all these companies had their own compilers, their own operating systems. HP still has HP UX floating around. IBM still has AX floating around. They all did these proprietary operating systems because they had to, in some sense, because there was no free software operating system that really worked available. They based a lot of stuff off BSD, which didn't really, it needed a lot of work, so they just proprietarized it when they did. But the thing is now they all deploy on GNU Linux systems and all this stuff, and it's basically, we're at a point now where it's so easy to get involved in development. People don't know what it was like. People don't know what it was like. Take MySQL, bring us back. Let me tell you my... Look, people don't realize that before MySQL, as an example, which is the example in this thing, before you had a GPL'd database, like, you had to deal with Informix. And like, one of the reasons I'm so hardcore free software, Karen is literally yawning as I'm talking. The reason I'm such so hardcore on free software is because I spent 4 years of my life part-time writing Informix 4GL and doing Informix database stuff and having bugs they wouldn't fix right? And that's a time when, by the way, Dave Neary was working in Informix at the time. It's his fault. But my point is that it wasn't really Dave Neary's fault. I'm kidding. But it was Informix's fault for being proprietary. And now, if you want to write a database application, you've got a series of free software databases to choose from that didn't exist.
Yeah, actually, I think what's more the problem is that there are comfortable environments to develop in that are not free and open. I think that to me is the biggest problem that's the problem. They're not free software. This is the thing. When we go to conferences with all free software developers and like more than half of them are using Macs, that's not about there being too much free software available. That's about comfort. That's about convenience.
But you're talking from a desktop perspective, which I agree with you about. But on the server side, the problem, you're right about the desktop side. I'm talking about I was mainly talking about the server side when I said that. The server side is as I described it. The desktop side is as you described it, which is basically.
I guess I'm more focused on the desktop side.
Well, not surprising, given that you're exactly right at GNOME Foundation. So I think that the problem, but I think it actually bleeds into your problem because on the server side, people have so much software freedom. And then they can build proprietary applications on top of it. And then they never face the problems of dealing with somebody else's proprietary software.
That they never become
hardcore. And then on the desktop, when it's convenient to use proprietary software, they end up doing so. It's like I was saying on the Floss Foundation's mailing list this week about the fact that free software projects are by and large using, if they want video chat, Google Hangouts and Skype. And I have somebody investigating Big Blue Button to maybe Conservancy can provide it to projects. And I'm hearing Big Blue Button may have a dependency on Flash.
Yep.
Adobe Flash, proprietary software. It's like, great. Somebody on the list was like, great, a free software solution for this. We're using it. It's great. And then, oh, no, but you need proprietary Flash and it doesn't work with Ganache. So what is that? I mean, that's not software freedom. That's giving in to proprietariness when it's convenient.
Right. It's choosing convenience.
Give me convenience or give me death.
Yeah.
So
very frustrating.
Yeah, I mean, this is why.
But this is why I think advocating to everybody is so important, because it's these fundamental concepts that we're all going to have to live with.
Yeah, although I don't know, but this wasn't Luik's point.
No, Luik's it wasn't. Point Luik's
was, point was that can a company do this? And I think that if a company's made up of people like Luik, can.
Well, certainly. But saying earlier in the channel that that you can't really necessarily talk about cloning people, but if we could clone Luik.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the things that he's talking about, which is basically making a company dependent on a code base that's multi-copyright held, that can actually, it sort of forces the company's interests into being friendly to it, being friendly to GPL enforcement, being friendly to the GPL being complied with correctly, because basically they're equal footing situation. Which I think Luik's making sort of the same point Michael Meeks was, in the sense that multi-copyright held projects are really important.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with both of them about that.
But what's interesting also is that Luik points out the peculiarities, or maybe not, I don't mean that in a negative way, but the individuality of French law for enforcement, and the way you need to have written a certain proportion or a certain amount of the code base in a certain way in order to be able to enforce on it. And, you know, that's tough, because if there's no enforcement, do we have copy left at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I've had a lot of, obviously, discussions. I should note that Conservancy cooperates with FSF France to do enforcement, and we're represented by the same attorney, and we've had discussions on our attorney-client privilege that I don't want to get into too much detail about.
Don't get
this.
Into any detail about it.
Okay, so I won't answer. I don't think it's as bad as it sounds.
Oh, okay, because I'm just relying on what Luik said in his.
I mean, I think that. The courts have a lot. The French courts have more of an uncertainty about copyright. In the same way that U.S. courts have this obsession with everything's copyrightable everywhere up and down, and they want to help the MPAA do whatever they want, enforcement and so forth. That tradition doesn't exist in the French courts. So there's a lot more open area. There's not cases already about lots of copyright stuff. So, and like most lawyers would be, everybody's conservative about what it all means until there's case law.
Yeah, of course.
And so there just doesn't exist.
My point was just that there might be uncertainty elsewhere too. So, you know, and when it comes down to it, at the end of the day, you know, diversely held copyrights are great for enforcement when you've got individuals that are willing to enforce and legal systems that support that. But where you don't, you know, aggregating copyrights in nonprofits makes a lot of sense. Not necessarily in companies, which is what, you know, Michael Meeks and indirectly Luik were talking about. But you know, I think there is a usefulness in that.
Yeah. I think everybody having a stake is important. I don't mind for-profit companies having a stake. I mean, the interesting thing is with the history of Samba and how they avoided having corporate copyrights because they didn't want companies to be enforcing the GPL because they were afraid companies would use it in a way that was not fitting with the community. And they felt that individuals could be trusted more. Now, they recently changed that policy, which I think that was more for pragmatic reasons. I don't know if they...
Was that GPL V3 patent reasons or no?
No. I don't think anything to do with that specifically. I think it was just more generally that they felt like letting companies hold copyright was not as much of a risk as it used to be. I think more in part of the termination provision of V3 being better in the sense that V2's termination provision being so strong and they didn't want companies to overuse it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think V3 is a safer license. It makes the business models that Loic was talking about less viable because you can fix the violation more easily, and if you were violating, you don't have to go back and beg for that proprietary license. You can say, well, I fixed it in time. And then the company that wants to do the MySQL business model has to be willing to go to court over, are they in compliance now? And
right.
have to argue these
right.
crazy compliance scenarios and say, oh, SQL is derived from the SQL server, like programs written in SQL. By the way, as is the tradition of former CEOs of MySQL, Loic told me he got an email from one of the former CEOs of MySQL about his talk.
Oh, really?
Which I guess we'll get emails now because we talked about it. I've gotten many an email from, I don't know which CEO, there's been many CEOs of MySQL. Martin Mikos sent me an email when I criticized Eucalyptics publicly. And they tend to come at you when you criticize their business model. These proprietary relicenser types. Martin Mikos's main point in his email to me was that if I wanted big profit for free software developers, this was the only way to do it. He literally used the word big profit. And I was like, I don't really want big profit. I just want people to make a living.
Yeah.
Big profit. Who needs big profit? I'm in the 99% man. I don't have big
profit. I was going to say, if you and I were focused on big profit, we wouldn't be where we are anyway.
True enough. Multiple people I ended up being at the New York Stock Exchange on May 1st because of the Linux Foundations event there.
Yeah.
And many of the developers I was talking to were talking about going outside to join the protesters when the conference was over. And then somebody pointed out something I really thought was if they were giving me a hard time entering the building, which they weren't there when I was entering the building or leaving for that matter. I was going to say to them, well, what operating system do you run? Do you realize I'm going upstairs to advocate for companies to give back to a commons code base under a license that requires share and share alike? And do you have a Mac?
There's a major disconnect there. But there's opportunity too, because I think people do wonder, you know, when you break it down for them, I think the Occupy protesters really start to understand.
Maybe.
In particular.
I don't know. I've had
some good conversations.
I don't think protesting works anymore because I think that the way it could change people's minds in the 60s and 70s, it just doesn't change people's minds in the way it did. I think it's wasted time, basically, when you could go set up soup kitchens and
I think it inspires people. And I think just seeing how the Occupy Wall Street movement caught fire and, you know, like took on life elsewhere in the country and caused people to hit the streets and think about it. It's been a topic that's been discussed.
But other than getting people to vote by waving their arms weirdly, what exactly has it gotten done?
I think it's certainly raised awareness. People really talk about these issues a lot more than they did now. And we have vocabulary to use that we didn't have before. Like exactly what you said about being the 99%, right?
But it hasn't changed. I mean, everybody the Wall Street people, the politicians are just laughing at those people. Everybody's just laughing. Is that as much as like the Tea Party, which amusingly used to call themselves the Tea Baggers until they realized they couldn't call themselves that anymore. But the Tea Party actually, for being on the other side completely, is much better organized and actually got candidates like Michelle Bachmann forward and so forth.
Yeah.
They actually made real change. And instead, basically, the instead of doing what like Michael Moore was trying to do 10 years ago, which was point out how conservative Clinton really was and how the Democratic Party was not available anymore to the people that –
Well, you should get involved.
With what?
With the Occupy movement and help them.
So I can get more emails from conservancy projects who are mad at me. I mean, like every day I get an email from some conservancy project wants me to do something. I mean,
that's the nature of being overworked and swamped.
I guess, but I mean, the thing is that everybody's angry at me all the time, and you know.
I'm not angry with you.
Okay.
All right. Anyway, we've gotten really far off topic. Freeze and Freedom is produced by Dan Lynch of Pod Factory and can be found at podfactory.org. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. This episode of Freeze and Freedom is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 United States license. You can follow Freeze and Freedom, Bradley, and Karen on Identica, and also read Bradley's and Karen's blogs. Links can be found on the Freeze and Freedom website, faif.us. That's faif.us.
Well, I'm glad that you find this useful. I guess that's the best I can do, I suppose.